Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Corporate debt we did yesterday. So on this Tuesday, then, federal debt, where the numbers are even bigger. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 16th of October today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin on this Tuesday with the current state of the national bank balance. Overdrawn, one might say. From the Treasury Department, the latest figures go like this. The federal deficit, that is the gap between what the government brings in and what it spends every year, grew 17% in the 2018 fiscal year. That is the one that ended just a couple of weeks ago. That is an annual, let me say that again, annual shortfall of $750 billion, $779 billion for those of you keeping score at home. A couple of things are going on here. The Trump tax cuts, for starters, also increased military spending as well. Now, what to do about it? Well, this morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called the deficit, quote, very disturbing, and then pinned the blame on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to look into how much government debt is too much for the American economy.
Like many questions in economics, the answer is...
there's no quick and easy answer.
Kenneth Rogoff is an econ professor at Harvard.
It's clear that the U.S. can bear a lot more debt than it has at today's low interest rates.
Even with bigger deficits, even with tax cuts that will add over $1 trillion to the debt in the next 10 years, we're not approaching that scary too much debt level, says Stephanie Kelton, a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University.
As some people would say, you know, the red lights are flashing and we're all sticking our heads in the sand and ignoring the clear and present danger. I don't see a clear and present danger.
Kelton says the U.S., like Japan, will always be able to pay its debts since it controls its own currency. It can just create more money to pay its bills. But do that too much and you risk higher inflation. And Kelton says it matters what the government is using its borrowed money to do. In other words, will the spending make the future economy more productive or not? That's looking at debt through an economic lens. Through a political lens, the debt may already be too big.
The likely scenario is there will be pressure to cut spending elsewhere.
Robert Pollin is director of the Political Economy Research Institute at UMass Amherst.
If the Trump administration is committed to continuing to increase military spending, the only place where you can get a substantial amount of savings out of the rest of the budget is in health care.
In other words, Medicaid and Medicare, which Senator McConnell mentioned this morning, though he did say their popularity makes them tough to cut. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Some of the winners from those Trump tax cuts are starting to show up in earnings reports. Banks, first among them, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, the list goes on, have all done well this earnings season. Plenty of companies are, of course, benefiting from the changed tax code. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports from WESA in Pittsburgh, the banks are a special case.
Before the tax bill, the corporate tax rate was 35%. Now it's 21%. And for banks and other financial institutions, that's doing one thing.
Boosting earnings.
That's Nicole Kading, director of federal projects at the Tax Foundation. She says while the corporate income tax was 35%, most companies found so many loopholes.
They weren't actually paying close to that.
But for more tightly regulated banks, the tax cut was really real. So that boost, plus a temporary provision in the tax law, allowing businesses to deduct capital expenses now and not over the years as they depreciate, means profits. Plus, the Fed just raised interest rates. Again, it's pretty much win-win-win for banks, says Avandir Subramaniam, finance professor at UCLA.
Because of the tax reform and because of the rising interest rates, and generally the economy is doing okay. So all of these things are lining up in favor of a persistent positive impact on profits.
But that tax cut is a one-time windfall for the banks. Going forward, they'll have to sustain the momentum when there's no tax cut. And next year's corporate tax rate will be 21%, just like this year. And that could be more challenging. Mark Mazur is an economist at the Tax Policy Center.
And so if they want to see an increase in their earnings per share, they'd actually have to have an increase in their earnings from operations.
Which could happen if you've got one eye on interest rates. You can see them inching up. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, you remember last week when Mariel Segarra told me her sources were telling her it was just a bad couple of days and that once corporate profits started rolling in, Wall Street would bounce right back? Well, did it ever. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I was flipping through the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier newspaper this morning. All right, that's not true. I saw the article on Twitter. But the paper reports that Volvo, which has a huge plant in Berkeley County, South Carolina, is thinking about moving production of some of its cars to China because of the president's trade war. And BMW, which has an even more huge plant in Spartanburg County that we visited a year or so ago, says that retaliatory Chinese tariffs are going to cost it $347 million this year and more than $500 million annually to come. We know a guy in Spartanburg, met him when we were down there. David Britt is a county councilman in Spartanburg County, also one of the people who convinced BMW to open a factory there in the first place. Ms. Britt, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you too, Guy.
So listen, this isn't exactly fair, but I'm going to play you back to yourself from the last time you and I spoke. We got you on the phone and I said, how are you worrying about these tariffs? What are you thinking? And here's what you said.
This action could have devastating effects. Across the board, and it could actually kill these great opportunities that we're having right now.
So here we are a number of months later. It looks like it's kind of coming true.
I'm prophetic. That's exactly right. Unfortunately, I wish I were wrong, but what is happening is, you know, the tariffs that the president's imposing is putting the foot on the throat of growth that we've had not only in Spartanburg, but in South Carolina, and I see it going across the country as well.
You're the guy, well, one of the guys anyway, who helped bring that original BMW plant to Spartanburg. How do you feel now that you see all this going on?
It's putting everything that we've worked for 26 years in jeopardy. We said it, you know, I've said it in Washington, and thanks to you, Kai, in your in Marketplace show, that's the reason Senator Orrin Hatch invited me to come and testify.
Yep.
He listened to your show. That's where he heard me, and
I
asked him, how did you find me? And they said, we heard you on Marketplace with Kai. But, yeah, this is the most serious thing that we have going in the United States.
Can you feel it around town?
All I have to do is walk down the street. I thought people would be a little upset with me, especially being in such a red state.
Yeah.
And I'm a Republican. I mean,
yep.
I voted for Trump 2 years ago. I thought some folks would say, David, what's going on? But the people in Spartanburg and South Carolina are saying, thank you for going to Washington. What else do we need to do? You know, we've never won a trade war. I mean, I've studied this a lot since, you know, you and I first started talking about this. I mean, since the 1850s, we do not win trade wars. We never have. And the people who actually lose in this whole process are the American citizens, whether you're in Spartanburg, South Carolina, or in the United States. It's not China. They're not paying anything in tariffs. It's a United States citizen. Look at me, what I'm wearing. Oh, you can't see me since you're on the radio. But
so
I'm wearing
you.
A Seiko watch made in Japan. I'm wearing a shirt that was made in India. My suit was made in Egypt. My shoes were made in Italy. I'm a walking billboard for international trade.
Do you suppose, sir, that there's an end in sight? I mean, the president doesn't look like he's backing down. The Chinese certainly aren't.
All those countries that are doing business in here in Spartanburg, I've made friends with a lot of those folks. I've been in every deal other than Michelin in 1978 when they first came. These countries and these partners that we've developed here in Spartanburg, they're worried about what's happening. I am hoping and praying that the president will come to a different opinion about the tariffs. These relationships I talked about that we build here in Spartanburg and South Carolina, they're done with a handshake, not a hammer.
David Britt sits on the Spartanburg County Council down in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Ms. Britt, thanks a lot for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Kai, thank you.
There are a couple of economic indicators you look forward to every month when you're a business and economics journalist. Seriously, you do. One of them is called JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, through which we learned this morning there are more open jobs in this economy than at any time since the government started keeping track, almost 20 years now. It's more than 7 million jobs, if you're curious, 7.14 million technically. And we're going to dig in a little bit on one slice of this labor economy with a whole lot of now hiring signs out there. Transportation. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that.
The transportation sector includes jobs in ride-sharing, railroads, airlines, and the big one, delivery. Sarah Kaufman at the NYU Rudin Center for Transportation says the demand for delivery has been going up year over year,
which increases the amount of freight vehicles in every city and across the country.
That demand has forced companies to beef up their shipping capacity and strategy. Just today, Macy's appointed the CEO of UPS to its board of directors. Satish Jindal at ShipMatrix says the failure of Toys R Us and the troubles at Sears have taught retailers a lesson.
Supply chain, logistics, transportation is a key element in achieving customer satisfaction.
But just because there are job openings in shipping, there's no guarantee they'll be filled. For example, there's a big shortage of workers for trucking companies, says Evan Raleigh at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management.
People are wary of investing too much now in being a truck driver.
Yesterday, the shipping company J.B. Hunt said it raised wages by 10% to attract new drivers. And on Friday, UPS is holding 170 job fairs across the country. Still, Raleigh says job seekers know these positions could be automated in the long run.
If you're young and you're investing in your future, you don't want to make an investment in a career that's going to be disappearing over time.
And for now, salaries are still low. Average pay for truck drivers rose by 1.9% over the last year, below the rate of inflation. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, so staying with that transportation theme here for a minute, there's news today of the ride-sharing variety. First, Lyft. The Wall Street Journal reports the company has picked the banks that are going to help take it public next year. J.P. Morgan tops the list in an IPO expected to value the company at more than $15 billion. Also, Uber. Proposals from investment banks hoping to snag its public offering have started to roll in. Morgan Stanley is on that list. Also, Goldman Sachs. Valuations like $120 billion are being bandied about. But here's the deal. Companies put a lot at risk if they go into the capital markets, into the stock market for the first time and don't get it right. So those valuations really matter. But where do they come from and who are they actually for? Marketplace's Emma Jacobs has that one.
Investment bankers have a term for the high-stakes competition to nab a company's initial public offering. They call it a beauty contest. And Kathy Smith of Renaissance Capital says Uber's beauty contest is, well, going to live up to the company's name.
The Uber IPO is going to be an Uber big deal and Uber big fees for investment bankers.
As in hundreds of millions of dollars in fees. All the contestants will tout their experience, connections, and skill at pricing and selling the company's shares. Each one will also estimate Uber's value. That's crucial and it's tricky.
With a company like Uber, there aren't very similar companies with which to compare them.
At least not publicly traded ones, says Jay Ritter, finance professor at the University of Florida. Ritter says current earnings aren't a good guide because Uber is still investing more money in the business than it's making, as in there are no profits.
The investment bankers have to make some assumptions to come up with a value.
A bank can boost its chances to win the deal by coming back with a big number, but exaggerating can set everyone up for disappointment later on. And Smith of Renaissance Capital says Uber shouldn't base its choice of bank too heavily on this kind of estimate anyway.
Once the IPO gets down the road and there's a meeting of buyers, investors, the pricing will be figured out.
That's expected to take place in 2019. And whatever happens, Uber's a pretty sure bet to be the largest IPO next year. I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's also super crowded, and it's probably annoying to have so many people come in every day.
Probably, but I think they're looking at you. First, though, let's do the numbers. Well, here's a really happy music. Dow up 547 today, 2.1%, closed at 25,798. The NASDAQ gained 214 points, 2.8%, 76.45. S&P 500 up 59 points, 2.1%, 28.09. Corporate profits and that JOLTS report if you're looking for proximate causes. Health insurer United Health shot up 4.7% today after posting better-than-expected third-quarter profits and raising its forecast for the full year. Cigna up 3.9% today. Tech stocks clawed their way back after some recent losses. Software maker Adobe slapped up 9.5% today. Microsoft firmed up 3.1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.16%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, so to review for those who might have blocked their near-term economic history memories, the near collapse of the American economy 10 years ago began as a housing crisis. Inflated home prices that everybody, almost everybody, I guess, thought could only go up went the other way. Millions of people lost their homes to foreclosure, banks began to fail, and the crisis was on. Our project about what that crisis and the Great Recession did to this economy is called Divided Decade. And one way that we've changed the past 10 years is that home ownership in this economy still isn't back to where it was. But should it be? Marketplace's Amy Scott has been looking into that.
Good morning. Please find your name on the sign-in sheet.
On a Saturday morning, 40-plus people crowd into a conference room near downtown Denver for a first-time homebuyer class offered by a local nonprofit. Many are here because they have to be to qualify for a mortgage or down payment assistance. Others, like 32-year-old Kelsey Milligan and her husband, are testing the waters.
We're kind of looking to plant roots and start a family in the next few years. And so we're trying to tackle, like, is this even feasible for us? What would it take?
Milligan has good reason to be cautious. She graduated from college in 2008 when millions of people lost their homes to foreclosure.
I watched my father lose his job. There was a lot of times where it was really stressful for us.
Since then, home ownership around the country hasn't recovered. Nationally, about 64% of households are owner-occupied, still 5 points lower than before the crisis. You might think that's healthy, that too many people bought homes before the crash. But Susan Wachter, a real estate finance professor at the Wharton School, says too much home ownership didn't cause the meltdown. It was how people paid for their homes.
Reckless mortgage lending is what drove the financial crisis and the resulting Great Recession.
You know, the second mortgages and cash out refinancing and exploding teaser rate loans. Consider what happened to Emily and Alfredo Cervantes. Back in 2002, they bought a townhome in a Denver suburb for less than $200,000. They had wanted a 30-year mortgage with a fixed rate, but their lender pushed an adjustable rate mortgage that started lower.
And us being young and not knowing very much said okay.
And for a while they did okay, living on Alfredo's salary as a mechanic while Emily went back to school. But after 5 years,
our rate jumped. Gosh, it doubled.
By that time, in 2007, the market had turned and home prices were falling. When they tried to refinance at a fixed rate, the bank said no. They owed more than the house was worth.
So we were left with either trying to sell the home or foreclosing and walking away, which is what we had to do.
11 years later, both 37, they're renting a small bungalow near downtown Denver and terrified that their landlord won't be able to resist the rising prices.
There's that uncertainty every year. You know, are they going to extend the lease this year for us, or is he finally going to sell the house?
That instability is one downside of the decline in homeownership, not just for families, but for communities. Lori Goodman is co-director of the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. She says homeownership is also the primary way most people build wealth to secure their retirement and pass on to their children.
So we want it to be available to those that are able to sustain it.
Goodman says while there's no ideal rate of homeownership, it probably should be higher than it is today. If credit standards were far too loose before the crash,
we are actually way too tight now.
She estimates more than 6 million people could have sustained homeownership over the past few years, but couldn't get mortgages.
Homeownership isn't for everyone, but it's for more people than we're letting through the door right now.
Emily and Alfredo Cervantes hope to get through that door again. Alfredo is a teacher now. Emily just started a full-time job as a health policy analyst. But now they're carrying more than $600,000 in student loans from graduate programs. Between that and a daughter nearing college,
to save up that amount of money that you need to purchase a home comfortably, I can't even think about how many years that's going to take.
So for now, they'll stay part of a new generation of renters who'd rather own. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can explore the rise of renters where you live with an interactive map that we've got online. It's at marketplace.org. There are, really broadly speaking here, two kinds of vacations. You can go someplace off the beaten path, have some peace and quiet, or you can go someplace on the beaten path, someplace so famous or picturesque or historic that you feel you kind of got to go. Venice, Italy is firmly in that latter category. 30 million tourists visit every year, many of them on cruise ships, actually. And while they do bring in plenty of revenue, locals fear their city is getting trampled. The BBC's Kevin Connolly has the story.
The sun is setting over Venice, and the first jazz musicians are already out to salute the evening. Every 20 minutes or so, one of those 5,000-berth cruise ships goes chugging past, obscuring and overshadowing the Renaissance masterpieces that the tourists they're carrying have come to see. They look pretty incongruous, like finding a rocket in a Rembrandt. And they're leaving many Venetians starting to worry that the city is feeling more and more like a theme park.
If we don't find a solution, we are going to be a Pompeii. Pompeii or Machu Picchu are cities with beautiful marbles, a lot of history, but without citizens.
Matteo Secchi is a campaigner who says that if things don't change, the only people that tourists will meet when they come to Venice will be tourists from somewhere else.
The tourism is 95% of our economy. But at the same time, more tourists and every day less Venetians and less real Venetian life.
Wherever you go in modern Venice, you find yourself squashing along in densely packed crowds. It's like permanently being in the process of leaving a packed theatre or football stadium. And the question is, can tourists destroy the very things they come to see?
You have to be back at 3:30.
And water taxis are very crowded.
Yeah, the water taxis.
The Williams family from Boston, Massachusetts, Diana and Ben, Stephen and Pamela, are enjoying the Piazza San Marco. But they have a problem. Their cruise ship schedule gives them 5 hours in Venice, and it took them two to get here from the port. Allowed 2 hours to get back, and that gives you an hour in the square. It's captivating, of course. You just have to be captivated quickly.
It's very busy. We would prefer if it was less busy.
Is it a problem that you basically only see other tourists when you come here? There are no kind of real people here.
I don't think anyone in this square is probably from Venice.
if I could paraphrase Groucho Marx, I'd rather prefer not to visit places that will accept the likes of us.
I can understand why locals don't want all of these cruise ships. It's kind of a double-edged sword because they probably want the money that we bring in, having tourists here, but it's also super crowded and it's probably annoying to have so many people come in every day.
Mariana Puriciol is a Venetian who worries about it all, but agrees there are no easy answers.
Some people suggest raising the prices. I don't agree with that because that would make prices higher for residents, and also it becomes an elitist. I think everybody has the right to see Venice. But perhaps a booking system? You know, there aren't enough public toilets. There aren't enough benches, places where you can sit and relax and, you know, have a picnic or just have a snack or just rest for a little bit. There are no resting areas. What do you do when you don't have any more room? You shut the door.
You are not welcome. You are not welcome.
Every year now, there's a demonstration in Venice against those great cruise ships. But from the deck of the departing ship, of course, it might look like any other firework display. Kind of thing that might incline you to come back again next year and maybe tell a friend.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly in Venice for us. This final note on the way out today, in which I am going to declare victory and depart the field. You remember a couple of weeks ago my rant? Yes, fine, it was a rant about the new iOS bagel emoji. Suffice it to say, it was more of a bread-ish frozen food section looking thing than an actual bagel. But Apple, it seems, has heard my cry. There is a new bagel emoji with the new iOS update that's out. More textured, conceivably, it could have been handmade with cream cheese, no less. All right, we're out. The Dow up 547 today, 2.1%. NASDAQ up 214, 2.8%. S&P 500 up 59 points, 2.1% there as well. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Zatar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.